who have become extremely wealthy as a result of their support for the military-industrial complex. So it is a transition period. It's going to take longer than I think most people would like. But in the end, the U.S., if it doesn't change its policy, it has already lost credibility. All parties. Israel has lost credibility for the next hundreds of years. And the question then is, can we bring something new out of this, which does recognize the humanity of all people, as opposed to accepting the idea that some people are more deserving of life than others?
Okay, and on that note, I'd like to thank both of you for being with me for this spotlight. Anthony Hall out of Lethbridge, Canada, Harley Schlenker out of Potsdam, Germany. And thank you for being with us on another spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi, signing off for myself and all the crew right here in Tehran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
And now we enlighten you with Ayah 260 to 263 of Surah Baqarah, recited by Shahriyar Parhizgar.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Wa idh qala Ibrahim Rabbi arini kayfa tuhyil mauta qala awalam tu'min qala bala walakin liyatma'inna qalbi قال فخذ أربعة من الطير فصرهن إليك ثم اجعل على كل جبل منهن جزءا ثم ادعهن يأتينك سعيا واعلم أن الله عزيز حكيم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة 100 حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى لهم أجرهم عند ربهم ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون قول معروف ومغفرة خير من صدقة يتبعها أذى والله غني حليم.
In the name of Allah, the All-Compassionate, the All-Merciful. And when Abraham said, "My Lord, show me how you revive the dead," he said, "Do you not believe?" He said, "Yes, indeed, but in order that my heart may be at rest." He said, "Take four of the birds, then cut them into pieces, and place a part of them on every mountain. Then call them, they will come to you, hastening. And know that Allah is Almighty and All-Wise." Those who spend their wealth in the way of Allah and then do not follow what they have spent with reproaches and affronts, they shall have their reward near their Lord, and they will have no fear, nor will they grieve. An honorable word with pardon is better than a charity followed by a front, and Allah is all sufficient, most forbearing.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The death toll from a U.S.-Israeli genocide in Gaza nears 19,000. Palestinian fighters remain engaged in heavy fighting, inflicting heavy losses on occupation forces. Pressure is mounting on the Israeli Prime Minister as he fails to free the captives from Gaza, while three of those held are killed by the regime's own forces. And key shipping firms pass a Red Sea travel as Yemen's army warns it will keep targeting Israel-bound ships unless medicine and food is allowed into Gaza. Hello everyone, thanks for tuning in to World News. And now it's day 71 of the Israeli war on Gaza, where fresh airstrikes have killed a dozen people in the southern city of Khan Yunis. Attacks in Khan Yunis targeted residential buildings and a UN-run school. Overwhelming number of casualties brought to Al-Nasser Hospital there forced medics to treat the wounded on the floors. Israeli warplanes also hit southern city of Rafah, killing over two dozen people. Also in Gaza City, at least two civilians were killed after a school was bombed. Death toll in Gaza is now around 19,000, but a Geneva-based NGO, the Euro-Mediterranean Human Rights Monitor, has put the toll around 25,000. Israeli attacks have crippled critical infrastructure as well. Palestinian telecommunications firms say that services have been cut again, hampering rescue efforts. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas says Israeli forces are crumbling in the Gaza Strip in the face of resistance fighters. Hamas military wing, the Al-Qassam Brigades, says this is despite the fact the resistance is pitted against an army equipped with the most advanced weapons and fighter jets. Qassam spokesperson Abu Ubaidah said its fighters have targeted more than 100 Israeli military vehicles over the last 5 days. The spokesperson also says fatalities of Israeli troops are multiple times greater than what the regime is acknowledging. Hamas has turned the streets of Gaza into a deadly maze for Israeli forces. The assessment is being made by Israeli experts and an Israeli commander. They say the movement has used weapons, stockpiles, knowledge of the terrain, and vast tunnel networks in Gaza to its advantage. Retired Israeli Major General Yaakov Admiror says the Israeli army has not found a good solution for Hamas's tunnel network. Also, foreign policy advisor to the Israeli Prime Minister Ofri Falk says that Tel Aviv is paying a huge price with the lives of its troopers. The regime has confirmed the deaths of around 110 of its forces in the offensive since nearly 2 months ago. Hundreds of Israelis have held a protest in Tel Aviv demanding that the regime make efforts to release captives being held by Hamas. Protesters first gathered outside a military compound and then marched through the city. They called for negotiations over the release of dozens of Israelis held by the Palestinian resistance group in Gaza. They also blamed Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu for killing three of the captives on Friday. The trio were killed by regime's own invading troops. Israel's incessant bombings and shelling earlier killed some other Hamas-held captives. More than 100 of the Israelis remain in custody in Gaza. That after a week-long truce in late November saw Hamas swapping more than 100 captives with 240 Palestinian women and children held in the regime's prisons. Hamas says the Israeli attack that killed an Al Jazeera cameraman in Gaza on Friday was deliberately targeted at journalists. Now, the movement says strike on a UN school was an attempt to intimidate news staff documenting the regime's massacres in Gaza. Earlier, Al Jazeera said an Israeli strike in Khan Yunis wounded two of its news staff. One of them, Samer Abu Dhaka, bled to death as Israeli forces prevented medics from reaching him. The news network has condemned the attack, saying that it holds Israel accountable for systematically targeting and killing journalists and their families. Over 80 news staff have been killed by regime forces since the 7th of October, when the Israelis began onslaught on the Gaza Strip. Yemen's armed forces say they've targeted two Israel-bound ships in the Red Sea.
The naval units of the Yemeni armed forces, with the help of God Almighty, carried out a military operation against two container ships, MSC Palladium and MSC Alania. They were heading to Israel and were targeted by two appropriate naval missiles.
Yahya Sari said attack came after two ships refused to respond to warnings by the Yemeni Navy. Spokesman vowed all Israeli-bound vessels will be targeted, but reassured all other ships passing near Yemeni territory of safe passage. Yemen says strikes are in response to Israel's deadly onslaught on Gaza, and Sana says it will continue the attacks until Israel stops its genocide in Gaza and needed food and medicine are allowed into the blockaded strip. The Danish shipping company Maersk said that it will pause all container shipments through the Red Sea. The company added that its shipments will be sent on a detour around Africa until further notice. Political commentator Hussein al-Bukhaiti says the Yemeni armed forces are serious in their pledge to target Israeli-bound ships, and so shipping lines should take the warning seriously.
If a container ship with thousands of containers on it, if it have only one container that should be going to Israel, this ship will be attacked. That's why all companies should take Yemeni warning seriously, because they will keep doing so until Israel will lift its blockade and allow food and medicine to go into Gaza. If they do so, then this means that any ship from any country will not be targeted, but the attack against Israeli-owned ship will keep and will continue until Israel will stop its attack and aggression against Yemen. And if they are not going to do so really soon, I believe that Yemeni army will announce that they will continue all its attack, either against any ship going to Israel, despite the fact what nationality, or Israeli ship, until Israel will lift its blockade and as well withdraw from Gaza and stop all its killing and release all prisoners that has been taken during the fight after October 7.
UN officials have sounded the alarm over the worsening humanitarian situation in Gaza. They say no place has been spared from Israeli airstrikes, including locations that should be protected under the law of war. The UN officials say half the population of Gaza is now starving.
UN agencies continue to sound the alarm bell over the desperate humanitarian situation in the besieged coastal territory. The head of the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees has warned that the people of Gaza are running out of time and options. Philippe Lazzaroni warned that Gaza is very far from an adequate humanitarian response.
The people of Gaza are running out of time and options as they face bombardment, deprivation, and disease in an ever shrinking space.
He described the situation in Gaza as hell on earth, and said people in the Palestinian territory are facing the darkest chapter of its history since 1948. He described seeing people halting in aid truck and in desperation and swallowing down the food found inside where they stood in the street. Further noted that the people of Gaza are now crammed into less than one-third of their original territory near the Egyptian border, and the dire situation might spark an exodus. The city of Rafah on the Egyptian border, the only crossing where aid is entering Gaza, has seen its population explode from 280,000 to more than a million.
Rafah is the epicenter of the displacement of the Gazan. There is over 1 million people who have fled in this governorate, and most of them, as we know, have been moved more than once since the beginning of the war. Rafah has quadrupled its number of people overnight, and especially when the offensive in the south has started.
UN officials have warned that any such exodus would be extremely destabilizing for Egypt, for the Sinai region, and it would make a problematic Palestinian problem more difficult. It is now widely believed that the Israeli regime is deliberately targeting residential areas and the critical infrastructure in Gaza in order to make the territory unlivable for its residents. Israel has already pushed the U.S. and its other Western allies to persuade Egypt to accept Palestinian people in the Sinai Peninsula.
It seems very difficult to us that if there was a population movement outside Gaza, I think that can only mean Egypt. It would be extremely destabilizing for Egypt, for the Sinai region, and that would make a solution to the Palestinian problem even more difficult.
The healthcare system is collapsing. Expect public order to completely break down soon. And an even worse situation could unfold, including epidemic diseases and increased pressure for mass displacement into Egypt. I said that we are facing a severe risk of collapse of the humanitarian system.
Now, doctors in Gaza are warning about spread of disease due to overcrowding at makeshift camps. They say the situation is particularly alarming among children, and it comes as infections have already soared among young patients due to poor sanitation. And this has raised calls for urgent action to avert a looming catastrophe.
UNRWA and many other aid organizations have already issued serious warnings about the dire conditions in Gaza. The UN Humanitarian Office also said that Gaza faces a public health disaster due to the collapse of its health system and the spread of disease. Doctors in Gaza are warning about the spread of diseases, especially among children, due to overcrowding and unhygienic conditions of makeshift camps, as well as a lack of medicine and clean water there. The lack of food, clean water, and shelter have worn down hundreds of thousands of traumatized people, and with the health system on its knees, its inevitable epidemics will rip through the territory.
We all know that the healthcare system is or has collapsed. We've got a textbook formula for epidemics and a public health disaster. This is in part, of course, because the shelters have long ago exceeded their full capacity, with people lining up for hours just to get to a toilet.
According to the data compiled by the World Health Organization, from November 29th to December 10, Cases of diarrhea in children under the age of 5 jumped 66% and climbed 55% for the rest of the population in the same period. The UN agency said the numbers were inevitably incomplete due to the meltdown of all systems and services in Gaza because of the war. Doctors of the pediatric ward at Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunis in southern Gaza have told reporters that the ward was overrun with children suffering extreme dehydration, causing kidney failure in some cases, while severe diarrhea was 4 times higher than normal.
The conditions of the war have led to the spreading of a lot of epidemics and sicknesses, the first epidemic of which has been one of acute gastroenteritis, which we have most frequent cases of in the children's ward. There are a number of patients come with cases of extreme dehydration, some of which can get to the point of kidney failure or weakening kidney function. Things are very bad.
I have 4 children with gastrointestinal diseases and flu. My youngest son has a cold, but we don't have any medicine. I have never felt as helpless and miserable in my life as I do now.
Since the truce between Israel and Hamas collapsed on December 1, hundreds of thousands of people have moved to makeshift shelters, abandoned buildings, schools, and tents. Many others are sleeping in the open with little access to toilets or water to bathe.
Children sleep in the tent while some adults have no choice but to sleep on the streets. There's no food, no water. The children lack milk and diapers. The situation is dire, with no sanitary conditions or toilets.
Gaza's 2.3 million people now find themselves in a daily struggle to find enough clean water to survive. Residents are forced to take seawater for daily use, despite health risks.
We have breaking news coming in. According to the Lebanese resistance movement, Hezbollah, a gathering of Israeli soldiers in the south of Lebanon, has been targeted, leaving several of them killed or injured. As soon as we get this developed, we'll get it out to you accordingly. Meanwhile, tensions are still high between Hezbollah and the resistance, the resistance movement, Hezbollah and Israeli forces along that Lebanese border since October 7th. Latest exchange or fire saw a Hezbollah fighter killed in Israeli shelling while resistance forces carried out missile attacks into occupied territories. And earlier we were joined by our correspondent out of Beirut, Maddie Amsalah, for some details.
Well, today we had intensified Israeli shelling basically on every single town throughout the border. Of course, Kfar Kila, Rabit Letin, Aita, Echiam, all these towns were targeted. That is on the eastern side. Also on the western side, you had a lot of other towns as well that were targeted. We're talking about Marwahin, Yarin, Aita Shab. They were targeted basically mostly on the outskirts. But you also had targeting in some instances, for example, in Aita Shab and Aitarun and Kfar Kila, for example, and Rabit Letin. Those we saw how the Israelis with artillery fire, they targeted the heart of those towns. Most of those towns are bordering the southern border, and basically they are mostly have been evacuated. Of course, Hezbollah has also launched several operations. One of the most significant operations was in the against the post of Meitab, where they used the Burkan rocket. And in addition to the use of the Burkan rocket, they also launched attacks against several gatherings of soldiers. One infantry was also seen entering the headquarters in its post, and that was also targeted directly by Hezbollah.
Iran's Islamic Revolution Guard Corps has released footage showing warnings to U.S. aircraft carrier against any provocation while a strike group was leaving the Strait of Hormuz earlier this month.
By witnessing Sepah Navy Batyu helicopters are flying unprofessional and provocative. You copy, huh? Keep your helicopter away from my vessel. U.S. Warship, by witnessing Sepah Navy, for your information, I have some speedboat going to you. Advise you to keep your helicopter away from my vessel. Over.
This is war, Discussion Warship 5-8. Understand all. Over.
In reaction to the incident, commander of the IRGC's naval force has said that the U.S. fleet was being closely monitored during its presence in the Persian Gulf. Rear Admiral Ali Reza Tangsiri added the presence of an American warship there was only meant for propaganda and had no operational value. Eisenhower aircraft carrier entered the Persian Gulf in late November and left through the Strait of Hormuz on December the 5th. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Saturdays. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Bismillah, words that seekers of sanctuary repeatedly recite, words that the very cautious in search of protection often repeat. I seek refuge with Allah, the Exalted above all, from the oppression of the unjust, from the deceitful malice the envious use to lay snares and traps, from the injustice and outrage of the tyrants, and I sing his praise. Do better and go beyond other praisers. O Allah, thou art one, has no partner, and is the Lord and Master without being made. There is no discrepancy or nonsense in thy commands, nor there is lawlessness in thy kingdom. I beseech thee to send blessings on Muhammad, thy servant, thy messenger. To let me ask thee for enlightenment and inspiration, so as to be thankful for thy bounties, which alone get thy approval ultimately. To help me to obey thee and instinctively worship thee, and make me deserve thy rewards on account of thy very patronage. And have mercy on me, and prevent me from breaking in the bounds of thy prohibitions, as far as I am kept alive, and show the way unto that which is useful and advantageous till I go on survive. To let me take to heart the meanings of thy book, and by its reading, throw down the heavy burden of sins, and receive welfare and salvation as a gift. Let not my family and friends who love me leave me alone. Let thy favors reach me in abundance during the remainder of my life, exactly as they used to be made available for me in full in the days gone by. Oh, the most merciful.
In the limelight. According to a new report released by Standard & Poor's Global, the Eurozone economy contracted at the fastest pace in nearly 3 years in October, as demand across the single currency union deteriorates. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. The European Central Bank warned that balance sheets of Eurozone banks are showing early signs of stress after a rise in loan defaults and late payments by customers. The European Central Bank said higher interest rates have boosted banks' income and profits for the time being, but lenders are facing pressure from higher funding costs, worsening asset quality, and lower lending volumes. The central bank also warned in its twice-yearly financial stability review that higher interest rates and slower growth were posing problems for people, companies, and governments in the Eurozone. It said higher borrowing costs were likely to lead banks to set more money aside to cover bad debts, hitting future profitability. However, the rise in defaults and late payments has come from a historically low level, and the European Central Bank believes the banking system should be able to cope with worsening asset quality thanks to strong capital buffers and liquidity levels. The European Central Bank's Vice President, Luis de Guindos, said the turbulence seen in the spring, when several lenders in the United States and Switzerland, including the Silicon Valley Bank and Credit Suisse, either collapsed or had to be rescued, had now abated. But while risks to financial stability may appear less acute, they remain elevated. The ECB's Vice President, Luis de Guindos, said, while the tight financial conditions created by the European Central Bank's run of interest rate increases should help bring inflation back down to target level, they can also push overextended borrowers into financial distress. He said people's disposable incomes, company revenues, and government finances may suffer an additional squeeze if economic activity disappoints further or if energy prices surge over the coming winter. The European Central Bank further said property companies were particularly vulnerable to losses as the downturn in the Eurozone's commercial real estate markets continued. Demand for office space fell sharply in the second quarter of this year, especially outside the prime sector. The European Central Bank's Vice President, Luis de Guindos, said financial markets have remained resilient, with expectations of a soft landing, a limited impact on economic growth as inflation recedes, but sentiment could shift quickly. Referring to the Israeli attacks on the Gaza Strip, Guindos said, an escalation of the conflict in West Asia could trigger a sharp increase in risk aversion in financial markets, unraveling the prevailing vulnerabilities. In addition to the potential adverse repercussions for the supply of energy commodities, an escalation could undermine general confidence and slow down economic growth, while pushing inflation rates up in parallel. The central bank outlined three main risks for Eurozone banks. First, the combination of higher living costs, higher debt servicing costs, and worsening economies could have a negative impact on bank asset quality. Second, higher lending rates, lower demand for loans, and tighter credit standards have led to a substantial drop in lending volumes, which will affect banks' profitability. And finally, banks' current strong profitability is also likely to come under pressure as their funding costs catch up with the interest rates paid on new business. The review said profitability is projected to decline in most countries going forward. Russia Today, the RT network, has also covered this story and tells us more. According to a new report released by Standard & Poor's Global, the Eurozone economy contracted at the fastest pace in nearly 3 years in October as demand across the single currency union deteriorated. The Purchasing Managers Index, the PMI of business activity, dropped to 46.5 last month, down from 47.2 in September, signalling a significant and accelerating contraction in output. October marked the fifth month in a row in which the index came in below the critical 50 threshold that separates expansion from contraction. The Standard & Poor's wrote, also pointing to a darkened economic outlook, was the stagnation of employment, as a 32-month run of job creation came to a halt. The report highlighted October's sharper downturn in activity reflected a worsening performance by service providers, as the decrease in factory production levels remained on par with that seen in September. Still, the later survey data signaled the third month in succession in which output has fallen in both monitored sectors. The research also showed that the declines in output were broad-based across the euro area, with the exception of Spain, where private sector activity came in flat in October. Germany and France continued to contract sharply, while Italy posted its fastest downturn since last year. Ireland registered its first decline in output in 11 months. Excluding the pandemic-hit months, the recent drop in new business was the steepest in September of 2012, during which time the Eurozone was embroiled in a sovereign debt crisis. Cyrus de la Rubia, chief economist at Hamburg Commercial Bank, said, "It looks like the service sector in the Eurozone is stumbling out of the gates for this final quarter. October marks the third straight month of business activity taking a hit. With new business diving steeply, it is not painting a rosy picture for what is ahead." Economists have warned that the economic output in the Eurozone could fall again in the fourth quarter of this year, which would indicate a recession. The British newspaper The Express has also covered the same story and tells us more. According to a monthly economic report from the Bundesbank on Monday, 20th of November, Germany's economy is expected to shrink again this quarter, facing challenges in its recovery. The Eurozone's largest economy has struggled this year due to factors such as high energy costs, weak global orders, and higher interest rates, leading to a deep industrial recession. The Bundesbank said that economic output is likely to decline in the fourth quarter of this year, and the German economy will face a tough recovery from the ongoing weakness since the start of the conflict in Ukraine. Germany experienced economic growth only once this year, and indicators for the final 3 months of the year have generally been worse than expected. The Bundesbank said the economic output is likely to once again decline slightly in the fourth quarter of 2023. The Bundesbank added, "The German economy is set to recover only arduously from the period of weakness that has persisted since the outbreak of the Russia-Ukraine conflict."
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is Gaza Under Attack, coming to you from the British capital, London. I'm Saeed Pourreza with you for some of the biggest talking points coming out of Israel's genocidal war on Gaza and its intensifying raids in the West Bank. First off, a quick roundup. Apartheid Israel continues its genocidal campaign against the 2.3 million Palestinians living in the world's largest open-air prison, also known as the Gaza Strip, even as the United Nations General Assembly overwhelmingly passes a resolution demanding a humanitarian ceasefire. The humanitarian crisis in the coastal enclave is deepening, with the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees saying Gaza has become one of the most dangerous places in the world. Meanwhile, more than 2 months into the war on Gaza, the resistance fighters are still standing. The Israeli army says 10 of its occupation soldiers, including a commander, were killed in the Strip on December 12 alone. Also, an admission by the U.S. and the EU of the Israeli military's indiscriminate bombing of Gaza and how that is costing the regime in Tel Aviv in public opinion terms. At least 18,612 Palestinians have been killed in Israeli attacks since October 7th. In the same period, at least 281 Palestinians, including 64 minors, have been killed in Israeli attacks in the occupied West Bank. So what now? What is the significance of that UN General Assembly resolution? Has the U.S.-led Western world seen enough Palestinians killed and maimed to try and stop the bloodshed? What happens if and when the shelling stops and the fog of war clears? And what can the pro-Palestine masses around the world do to keep the pressure on and to put an end to the siege of Gaza and to apartheid? Let's tackle those questions and more with academic consultant UK and South Asia, Dr. Sayeda Annie Waqar. Dr. Waqar joined UNICEF as a goodwill ambassador to Commonwealth countries in 2002. She has also extensively researched the various issues relating to nuclear security in South Asia and the Middle East, defense, arms control, and international relations. And via Skype from Leicester, optician and founder of Friends of Al-Aqsa, an NGO based in the same city, Ismail Patel. Mr. Patel is also an advisory board member of the Conflicts Forum, director of Islam Expo, and a member of the special advisory board of Clear Conscience. Thanks for joining us. To both of you. Starting with you, Dr. Waqar, I usually try to start the show by asking our guests for their thoughts on what we have been seeing happening, unfolding in the Gaza Strip, in the West Bank. As early as today, exclusive video was aired on the Qatari news channel of bodies piled up inside a school in Al-Fallujah area, west of Jabalia refugee camp in northern Gaza, with people shot in the back of the head at point blank. Your thoughts, really, on that?
I mean, first of all, it's one of the most horrendous, you know, unfolding of events that is happening in front of us. And with whatever has been happening with the Palestinians, especially, it's just an eye-opener for the international community as well, because this just did not start on October 7th. This has been going on for many, many years. And with what we have at the minute, an apartheid state, which is actually making sure in every way that they have nobody left, especially when it comes to the younger generation. Mm-hmm. Obviously, I mean, as an academic, reading up the history of the whole of this conflict, you can clearly see how the Zionist agenda within the Israel administration has been put forward in such a way and how it's been indoctrinated into the society, or the Israeli society, mm-hmm. that it makes it quite evident that they want to actually take over even those occupied Palestinian territories. Mm-hmm. So it's very clear from history to now. And I think what it has actually made, actually mostly the international community, most of the Western academics that I'd been actually working with, who had no actually idea of the history, or much of the history mm-hmm. of Israel and Palestine, it's an eye-opener for them, because now they're actually looking back. Not on the basis of, you know, whatever has been happening in terms of the religious aspect of it, but as a humanitarian, you know, if you have even an ounce of humanity in you, you would actually go back and look at these history books and see where, how this conflict started and what exactly is happening now. Mm-hmm. So I think it's quite welcoming to see that in the UN General Assembly, the 153 states actually went on to go ahead with the ceasefire. But yeah. The problem is not that. The problem is that one of the biggest country, which is apparently the powerful country in the world, has not actually been able to
support it.
So that's quite appalling to see. Yeah.
And speaking of this being an eye-opener, people not knowing about the history before that, it's also an eye-opener that there's such a lack of information out there. And I think the recent events have helped that change. Let's bring in Dr. Patel. Dr. Patel, on that UN General Assembly resolution, okay, the U.S. expectedly voted against it, just like it did in the UN Security Council just last week. But what I would like to ask you is, what do you think is the significance of it, despite knowing that it's a non-binding resolution?
Well, I think what has happened is the United States of America, and particularly by repeatedly supporting Israel and vetoing the resolutions of the Security Council, has made the UN unfit for purpose. And this undermining of the United Nations really is very, very dangerous, because now we have one body that tries and bring about a united move for the global society, the global nations, to work towards resolving an issue. By America continually vetoing resolutions against Israel or for what to bring Israel into account means that it's undermining the whole structure, not of the United Nations and of how the world governing bodies can operate. And I think that is very dangerous situation that we're in. And I think the United Nations itself is in jeopardy as an organization and as a body to
we'll
move forward.
About the UN and its role, its legitimacy as a body. But do you think the fact that so many countries voted for that resolution at the UN General Assembly ended up isolating the United States and Israel and a number of other countries who should be named and shamed, of course, for not having done so?
Absolutely. I mean, it exposes the globe in a way that, unlike any other time, the fact that almost 90% of the world wants a ceasefire, two nations in particularly, United States supporting Israel and United Kingdom abstaining, shows that they are isolated in the world. It also shows the hypocrisy of these two countries, in particular Britain and USA, that they cannot go around the world and talk about democracy, the principles of humanitarian law, and the right of self-determination when they themselves are undermining that for the Palestinian people. So not only does it expose them in support of Israel, but it also exposes them of their hypocrisy and their duplicity.
Correct. Dr. Waghar, based on your work on nuclear non-proliferation and disarmament in the Middle East, why do you think Israel has so for many years been exempt from nuclear disarmament talks or even inspections? We know Israel does not acknowledge that it has nuclear weapons, nor does it deny it. You know, there's always a state of ambiguity about its nuclear program or capability. What do you think that is, despite the fact that we know they're so irresponsible, there's no restraint in the terms of the military action they take as we are seeing it happen in the Gaza Strip?
Yeah, this is a very interesting question, and I'm glad that you've actually asked it, because, well, I have extensively researched on nuclear proliferation, especially in the region, looking at the history of Israel, you'll see that they have always had this nuclear ambiguity. And this is one of their very important stance when it comes to
the modus operandi.
Yes, modus operandi. But historically, if we look back, during the 1960s, there was a memorandum that was sent by Henry Kissinger to President Nixon. And in that memorandum, basically, it was stated that although it's quite dangerous that Israel already has the nuclear capability, mm-hmm. and they are actually working towards it. So it would be wise to actually have some sort of a leverage with them or have a sort of a deal with them, mm-hmm. so that it's eventually, it will not actually be a hindrance or be actually dangerous within the Middle East. Also, during that time, as you know, the tension between the Soviets and the US and obviously the Middle East. So they wanted to have a bit of a leverage. So it's obviously that memorandum is actually quite a secret classified document, but, you know, some parts of it had been released and, you know, most of the people can actually view it online.
You saw the revelations by Mordecai Vanunu, that nuclear whistleblower.
Yes. So so it's quite interesting to see how they were actually provided with phantom fighters to leverage for this nuclear ambiguity, because they did not want this to come out. And if it did, obviously that would have implications for the rest of the Middle East, also for U.S. own interest. Mm-hmm. So I think if you look back at the history, you'll see that this is how it started. But most of the times with all these international treaties and international organization, the countries usually actually do cheat on them. Mm-hmm. And mostly the superpowers, who are the ones who are the harbinger for creating these international treaties and laws, are the ones who actually have loopholes or have created loopholes where they can actually leverage on those bases. And this is exactly what United States did with Israel. They said, you sign the treaty, NPT, and we will and keep it as ambiguous, and we'll let you have these concessions, which unfortunately they did not sign.
Wow.
Yeah.
Thanks for that history there. We spoke at the United Nations. Let's talk about that a little more. The UN General Assembly voted overwhelmingly on December 12th to demand a humanitarian ceasefire in Gaza, as we've been saying, in a strong demonstration of global support for ending the genocide in Gaza. The vote also shows the growing isolation of the U.S. and Israel. The leaders of the Arab group, led by Palestine's UN Ambassador Riyad Mansour, said, quote, this draft resolution demands an immediate humanitarian ceasefire. The Arab group has vowed to keep up the pressure to secure a cessation of violence.
We will not rest until we see compliance of Israel with this demand from the General Assembly, so that we can see a ceasefire in place, so that we can move into the massive amount of truckloads of assistance, humanitarian assistance, of food, medicine, water, and fuel in order to run the hospitals, to run the plants for desalination, and all needs of the things that we need, our people to need for survival. Today was a historic day in terms of the powerful message that was sent from the General Assembly, and it is our collective duty to continue in this path until we see an end to this aggression against our people, to see this war stopping against our people. It is our duty to save lives. Saving lives is much nicer and better than taking it away. Death is bad. Life is wonderful. We thought that having pauses for a few days without fighting, then to be renewed, would create an atmosphere and dynamic of a permanent ceasefire. It did not work, which means that the main force, which is the United States of America, was still intact, siding with Israel completely and not being cracked. Now, and even last Friday and today, it was obvious that this powerful force is beginning to crack, and it is losing support except from a handful of countries that are not that significant.
The Palestinian ambassador to the UN, Riyad Mansour, there. Let's continue the conversation. I want to bring in Dr. Patel. Dr. Patel, you mentioned the weight of the United Nations, the legitimacy of the UN now being called into question. It's not the first time, is it? You remember the prelude to the Iraq War, many anti-Iran resolutions, but yet when it comes to a resolution that is supposed to stop bloodshed and stop Israel from carrying its genocidal campaign against Palestinians, somehow it doesn't happen.
We must recall that the United Nations' primary goal, of course it has many issues, but the primary issue is to bring about peace and to make sure there's no conflict. And it's failing in its primary objective, not because of the UN itself, but because of the structures of the UN that were itself created by the superpowers of the time, Britain, France, Russia, and United States of America, and to a certain extent, China. And what we have now is the United States of America repeatedly throughout the history of the United Nations, which coincides with the birth of the State of Israel or the Nakba, has supported Israel to continue with its colonization, its occupation. And this undermining really, as I mentioned earlier, is dangerous for us, for the global society. But of course, for the immediate time, it means that there is a continuation of the loss of life in Gaza, the unfolding of the genocide. And, you know, every day, every hour we speak, more and more people are dying. So this is actually a very acute phase that we would hope that the United Nations would be able to trump the desires of the United States, unreserved support for Israel. And in a way, the General Assembly's vote shows that the world society wants that to happen. Yet now the only country that is obstructing that primarily is the United States of America.
What about you? What do you think, Dr. Wagara? The fact that the UN was created post-World War to prevent war from happening again, and it doesn't seem to be, at a time like this at least, living up to its purpose. It's not fit for purpose anymore. Should we move towards a world where we have a world body that works for everybody and not for certain powerful countries or countries that have powerful backers?
Yes, I actually pretty much agree with Mr. Patel with regards to the structure of the United Nations. Precisely, historically, it was created to actually prevent any other major world war from happening. But unfortunately, I mean, after the Second World War, we have been seeing skirmishes of war throughout the world. It's just not, you know, one major world war, but mostly most of the countries in particular regions are involved in some sort of, you know, wars.
Yeah.
The structure of the United Nations, I think that's where the problem really is. When an organization that big is created by certain superpowers of that time, you will eventually see that the structure has some sort of, there will be certain loopholes for these superpowers to be able to maneuver in some way where they eventually, for instance, because my work is purely on nuclear non-proliferation, and when I look at the NPT, the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, I think that it's one of the biggest hypocritical treaty, because you have all the nations who already have nuclear stockpile,
you know, arsenals,
declared as or known as the nuclear states, whereas you have certain, you know, articles within the treaty which allows some of the states to actually get some sort of nuclear know-how for energy purposes, for peaceful purposes.
Such as Iran.
Precisely. And hence, in that, in those ways, you'll see that there are so many loopholes which have been created to be able for the countries who aspire to grow to be actually stopped on the steps.
Mm-hmm.
So unfortunately, I think it's the structure of how the Permanent Security Council is. I think it should be evolved. Why do we have just the five? Why can't we have other growing or emerging, you know, nations apart? Or actually, the Security Council should grow as the world is economically growing.
And because of the fact that it's not growing, and certain powers such as, again, the U.S., the U.K., old backers of Israel, have the wield veto power in the Security Council that allows Israel to continue with its genocidal campaign against the Palestinians for as long as it wishes.
True.
And whenever it wishes to do so.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And if one party to the Security Council vetoes, obviously, that's where the problem is.
Yeah.
And that's what we are seeing right now.
We're going to pivot to what we heard earlier, the groundswell of support for Palestinians, the international solidarity with Palestinians here in the UK and beyond. I'll start with Dr. Patel. You have helped organize these protests that we have seen over the past more than 2 months. How did you do it to bring out so many people? And also, what kind of impact do you think these protests have had on the political establishment here?
First, let me say it's interesting to see someone who's doing a PhD of some of the work that we are doing in our lifetime. So I think that's quite encouraging that we must be doing something right. But going back to your question, really, I think it's a long-term impact of the work that has been done for over the past few decades. I mean, we've been around for nearly 30 years now, PSC even longer, and we're the two main, if you like, bodies that are then surrounded with another four organizations. And united, we have been able to make sure that the issue of Palestine remains within the psyche of the British public. And I think that has been very important, because when major events like the attack on Gaza takes place, then the people are mobilized and they're very well informed of the situation. And they can see, they understand the context of the situation and the dangers. Because when we say in our marches that we are all Palestinians, it is not simply an affiliation of loyalty, but it literally means that we, even in Britain, in a way are suffering what the Palestinians are going through at much lesser scale. And what I mean by that is that while the Palestinians are being bombed and killed, a very high price being paid by them, we in Britain are being denied our freedom of speech, our freedom of democratic rights, the freedom of expressing ourselves. And this curtailing of our freedom here are reflected because of our support for the Palestinians, and hence the slogan, "We are all Palestinians." So it has a very big resonance of between us and the Palestinians. And the other thing to remember is those people who are shouting these slogans, most of them have no religious affiliation, no political affiliation. They don't even know most probably where Palestine is on the map, but they can feel the human essence and the suffering of the Palestinians and their denial that can be resonated with themselves, the underprivileged here in Britain. And I think those are the things that brings us together. And this is one of the many reasons, if you like, that you see so many people coming out. And something amazing about the demonstrations in Britain, that it encompasses almost all people of the different genres that are made up in the British society, from ethnic minorities to the conservative, if you like, not the political sense, but the city dwellers to village dwellers. You have people white, black, you have socialist to other political spectrum. And you have all these people coming together for understanding that what is happening to the Palestinians is an injustice on a grand scale, or from different aspects of occupation, colonialism, the humanitarian violation, and the negation of international law, and all these aspects, I think, feed into it. But to go back to your original questions, the only reason we're able to bring out so many people is because of the long-term work that we have been doing ourselves and the other sister organizations with us.
Well, keep up the great work, because you've done very well. And also, I think it's the multiculturalness, as you mentioned, of these protests that is not going down well with the right-wing political establishment here, and definitely not in the halls of power in Tel Aviv. Dr. Waghar, we heard what the UA top policy chief, foreign policy chief, Joseph Borrell, had to say. From the American President Joe Biden off camera, expressing concern about the casualties and even saying that Israel is losing popular support, as if it had massive popular support around the world. Is it really because of the sheer scale of the Palestinian casualties? Or is it perhaps in the Western world there's an appetite to a certain point to really take this number of casualties and then before they, call for a ceasefire or some kind of action, or asking Israel, on the one hand, of course, to exercise restraint, while on the other hand providing it with all the weaponry it needs to carry on?
One of the most interesting, I think, things that I have noticed about this whole issue with regards to this conflict is that most of the past colonial powers are the ones who are pretty much supportive of Israel and pretty much, the ones who are actually funding in whatever way they can in terms of their own national interest, as well as obviously Israel's interests. I do think that the major powers have an appetite for something like that, because when they see something going to this mass scale, I think also at the same point we have some mounting international pressure coming from all, you know, parts of the world. And hence, I suppose that Biden is kind of obviously becoming quite unpopular in his own country. And perhaps by the next election, he's definitely out.
Sorry to interrupt, but this change, this it means that they're not necessarily concerned about Palestinian lives. It's about their own politics.
That is absolutely correct. Yes, absolutely correct. It's about their own politics. It's about their own interests. It has nothing to do with whatever is happening with the Palestinian people. I mean, had they even an ounce of, you know, humanity in them, they could have actually just, along with the other international...
Who helped prolong the ceasefire.
Precisely. So I do think that it's always to do with their own interests. And like I said, again, I'm reiterating the fact that these are all post-colonial powers, yes. You know, who have... you know, gone into certain countries, taken out the indigenous population, and made their own, you know, mark. So it's quite a...
And hence the designation of Israel as a settler colonial entity.
Precisely.
In that part of the
yes.
world.
Yes.
All right. That's all the time we have for this program. With those comments, we're going to wrap up this show. Many thanks again to my guests for their contributions. Gaza under attack. We'll be back with more. Until then, keep Palestine... in your hearts. Goodbye.
In the limelight.
The Zionist regime's genocidal war on Gaza has involved continuous attacks on the healthcare system. According to the World Health Organization, 24 out of Gaza's 36 hospitals were damaged between October 7th and December 7th. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay